The Bernskart building had once been an Ixion fighting mech factory, one of the sacrilegious industries that defied the holy commandments of the Butlerian Jihad. But not anymore. Hydar Fen Ajitika gazed at the rows of tanks and attendants, satisfied now to see that the place had been fully cleansed and put to good use. God will approve. Following the Tleilaxu victory, the facility had been emptied of its poisonous machinery and blessed by fully robed masters, so that it could be used for the exalted purposes of the Bene Tleilax. Despite the commandment and support from old Emperor Elrud, now dead, Ajitika had never considered this an imperial project. The Tleilaxu did not act for the benefit of anyone but themselves and their god. They had their own purposes, which would never be understood by the unclean outsiders. Tleilaxu strategy is always woven within a web of strategies, any one of which may be the real strategy, he intoned the axiom of his people. The magic of our god is our salvation. Every axolotl tank contained the ingredients of a different experiment, each representing an alternate avenue for solving the artificial melange problem. No outsider had ever seen a Tleilaxu axolotl tank, and none understood their true function. To produce the precious spice, Ajitika knew he would have to use unsettling means. Others would be horrified, but God will approve, he repeated in his secret soul. Eventually, they would mass-produce the spice. Realizing the complexity of his challenge, the master researcher had brought in technological adepts from Tleilax I, learned men who had widely divergent views on how that goal might be attained. At this early point in the process, all options must be considered, all evidence studied for clues to be inserted directly into the DNA code of organic molecules, which the Tleilaxu called the language of God. All of the technological adepts agreed that artificial spice must be grown as an organic substance in an axolotl tank, because the tanks were holy sources of life and energy. Master researchers had nurtured countless previous programs with astounding results, from sligs to clones and golas, though there had been many unfortunate failures as well. These exotic vessels were the most sacred of Tleilaxu discoveries, with their workings shielded even from Crown Prince Shaddam, his aides, and his Sardaukar. Such secrecy and security here on Ix, now Xuta, had been a requirement of the original bargain with Emperor Elrud. The old man had agreed with deprecating amusement, must have assumed he could take those secrets whenever he wished. Many people made such ridiculous assumptions about the Tleilaxu. Ajitika was accustomed to being dismissed by fools. No one other than a Tleilaxu master or a full-blooded Tleilaxu researcher would ever have access to this knowledge. Ajitika drew a deep breath of the rank chemicals, the unpleasant humid stink that was an inevitable consequence of the functioning tanks. Natural odors. I feel the presence of my God, he thought, forming the words in Islamiyat, the arcane language that was never spoken aloud outside of Kales, the secret councils of his race. God is merciful. He alone can guide me. A glow globe floated in front of his eyes, blinking red. Long, long, short, pause. Long, short, color change to blue. 5 rapid blinks, and back to red. The Crown Prince's emissary was anxious to see him. Hydar Fen Ajitika knew not to keep Hasimir Fenring waiting. Though he had no noble title of his own, the impatient Fenring was the Imperial heir's closest friend, and Fenring understood the manipulations of personal power better than most great leaders in the Landsraad. Ajitika even bore a certain amount of respect for the man. With resignation, Ajitika turned and passed easily through an identity zone that would have been deadly to anyone not properly sanctioned. Even the Crown Prince himself would be unable to pass through safely. Ajitika smiled at the superiority of his people's ways. Ixians had used machinery and force fields for security, as the ruthless and clumsy suboid rebels had discovered, causing messy detonations and collateral damage. Tleilaxu, on the other hand, used biological agents, unleashed through ingenious interactions, toxins and nerve mists that rendered Poinda infidels lifeless the moment they set foot where they didn't belong. Outside in the secure waiting area, a smiling Hasimir Fenring greeted Ajitika as the researcher exited the identity zone. From some angles, the weak-chinned man looked like a weasel, and from others, a rabbit, innocuous in appearance, but oh, so dangerous. The two faced each other in what had once been an Ixian lobby connected through an intricate network of Clearplas lift tubes. This deadly Imperial killer stood more than a head taller than the master researcher. "Ah, my dear Fenajidika," Fenring purred. "Your experiments go well, Crown Prince Shaddam is eager to receive an update as he begins the work of his Imperium. "We make good progress, sir. Our uncrowned Emperor has received my gift, I presume?" "Yes, very nice. And he sends his appreciation." He smiled tightly as he thought of it. A silver-furred hermafox, capable of self-replication. An unusual living bauble that served no useful purpose whatsoever. "Wherever did you come up with such an interesting creature?" "We are adepts with the forces of life, sir." The eyes, Ajitika thought. Watch his eyes. They reveal dangerous emotions. Vicious now. "So you enjoy playing God?" Fenring said. With controlled indignation, Ajitika retorted, "There is but one God, All High. I would not presume to take his place." "Of course not." Fenring's eyes narrowed. "Our new emperor sends his gratitude, but points out one gift he would have greatly preferred. A sample of artificial spice." "We are working hard on the problem, sir, but we told Emperor Elrud from the outset that it would take many years, possibly even decades, to develop a completed product. Much of our labor heretofore has simply been consolidating our control on Xuta and adapting the existing facilities." "You've made no tangible progress, then?" Fenring's scorn was so extreme that he couldn't conceal it. "There are many promising signs." "Good. Then may I tell Shaddam when he should expect his gift? He would like to receive it prior to his coronation, in 6 weeks' time." "I don't think that is possible, sir. You brought us a supply of melange as a catalyst less than a standard month ago." "I gave you enough of the stuff to buy several planets." "Of course, of course, and we are moving as quickly as possible. But the axolotl tanks must be grown and modified, probably through several generations. Shaddam must be patient." Fenring studied the little Tleilaxu, looking for signs of deception. "Patient! Remember, Ajitika, an emperor does not have unlimited patience." The dwarf-sized man did not like this imperial predator. Something in Fenring's overlarge dark eyes and his speech carried a threatening undertone, even when discussing mundane subjects. "Make no mistake, this man will be our emperor's enforcer, the one who will murder me if I fail." Ajitika took a deep breath, but concealed it in a yawn to avoid showing fear. When he spoke, it was in the calmest of tones. "When God wills our success, it will happen. We move according to his schedule, not our own, and not Prince Shaddam's. That is the way of the universe." Fenring's huge eyes flashed dangerously. "You realize how important this is? Not only to the future of House Corino and the economy of the Imperium, but to your personal survival as well?" "Most certainly." Ajitika did not react to the threat. "My people have learned the value of waiting. An apple plucked too soon may be green and sour. But if one merely waits until it is ripe, then the fruit is sweet and delicious. When perfected, the artificial spice will alter the entire power structure of the Imperium. It is not possible to engineer such a substance overnight. Fenring glowered. We have been patient, but that cannot continue. With a generous smile, Egidica said, If you wish, we can convene regular meetings to display our work and progress. Such distractions, however, would only slow our experiments, our substance analyses, our settings. No, keep on, Fenring growled. I've got the bastard where I want him, Egidica thought, and he doesn't like it one bit. Still, he had the distinct impression that this assassin would do away with him without a second thought. Even now, despite the tightest security scans, Fenring no doubt carried a number of weapons concealed within his clothing, skin, and hair. He will make the attempt as soon as I'm not needed, when Shaddam thinks he has everything he wants. Idar Fenegidica had his own concealed weapons, though. He had set up contingency plans to deal with the most dangerous of outsiders, to ensure that the Tleilaxu remained in control at all times. Our laboratories may indeed come up with a substitute for the spice, he thought, but no Poindah will ever learn how it is made. Our timetable will achieve the stature of a natural phenomenon. A planet's life is a vast, tightly interwoven fabric. Vegetation and animal changes will be determined at first by the raw physical forces we manipulate. As they establish themselves, though, our changes will become controlling influences in their own right, and we will have to deal with them too. Keep in mind, though, that we need control only 3% of the energy surface, only 3%, to tip the entire structure over into our self-sustaining system. Pardot Kynes, Arrakis Dreams. When his son Leet was a year and a half old, Pardot Kynes and his wife embarked on a journey into the desert. They dressed their silent child in a custom-fitted stillsuit and robes to shield his skin against the sun and the heat. Kynes was delighted to spend time with his family, to show them what he had accomplished in the transformation of Dune. His entire life rested on sharing his dreams. His three apprentices, Stilgar, Jorak, and Amun, had tried to insist on going along to protect and guide him, but Kynes would hear none of it. "I've spent more years alone in the wilderness than any of you have been alive. I can handle a few days' sojourn with my family." He made a shooing gesture with his hands. "Besides, haven't I given you enough work to do? Or shall I find additional tasks?" "If you have more for us to do," Stilgar said, "we will gladly do it for you." Just keep yourselves busy," Kynes said, nonplussed, then set off on foot with Freeth and young Leet. The baby rode one of the Seech's three Kulans, a domesticated desert ass that had been brought to Dune by smugglers and prospectors. The animal's water price was high, despite its inbred adaptation to a harsh, arid environment. The Freeman had even developed a modified four-legged stillsuit for the beast, which saved some of the moisture the animal exuded. But in such a contraption, the Kulan had difficulty moving, in addition to the fact that it looked ridiculous, and Kynes decided not to bother with such extreme measures. This required taking extra water on the journey, which the animal carried in leiterjons attached to its back. In the shadow of morning, the tall bearded Kynes led his small party up a winding thread that only a freeman would have called a path. His eyes, like Freeth's, were the blue of the Ibad. The desert ass picked its way up the precipitous slope, but made no sound of complaint. Kynes didn't mind walking. He had done so for much of his life, during his years of ecological study on Seleucia Secundus and Bella Tejus. His muscles rippled, whipcord tough. Besides, when he went on foot, He could keep his eyes focused more on the pebbles and varying grains of sand beneath his boots than on the distant mountains or the sweltering sun. Eager to please her husband, Freeth turned her attention every time Kynes pointed out a rock formation, studied a spot of ground for its composition, or assessed sheltered crannies as possible sites for planting future vegetation. After a time of uncertainty, she also pointed things out to him. "A freeman's greatest strength is in observation," Freeth said, as if quoting an old proverb for him. "The more we observe, the more we know. Such knowledge gives us power, especially when others fail to see."
Interesting.
Kynes knew little about his freeman wife's background. He'd been too busy to ask her for many details about her childhood and her own passions. But she didn't seem in the least offended by his preoccupation with the terraforming work. In freeman culture, husbands and wives lived in different worlds connected by only a few narrow and fragile bridges. Kynes knew, however, that freeman women had a reputation as ferocious fighters, deadly on the battlefield, and feared above even imperial soldiers in one-on-one combat. So far, he had managed to avoid uncovering Freeth's vicious streak, and he hoped never to see it for himself. Fiercely loyal, she would make as formidable a foe as she did a friend. As he trudged along, a small piece of vegetation caught his eye. Halting the Kulan behind him, he knelt to inspect the small pale green plant that grew in a shaded niche where dust and sand had collected. He recognized the specimen as a rare root plant and brushed the dust from its tiny waxy leaves.
"Look here, Freeth," he said, like a teacher, his eyes shining. "Marvelously tenacious."
Freeth nodded. "We have dug those roots in times of need. It is said a single tuber can yield 0.5 liter of water, enough for a person to survive for several days." Kynes wondered how much desert knowledge Stilgar's sister held within her freeman mind. Until now, she had shared virtually none of it with him. It was his own fault, he told himself, for not paying enough attention to her. Eager to eat the fresh leaves of the struggling plant, the Kulan lowered its muzzle to the ground, nostrils flaring as it sniffed. But Kynes nudged it away. "That plant is too important to be a snack for you." He scanned the ground, intent on finding other tubers, but noticed none in the immediate vicinity. From what he had learned, these plants were native to Dune, survivors of whatever cataclysm had drained or diverted the moisture from this world. The travelers took a short break to feed their child. As Freeth set up a shade floater on a ledge, Kynes recalled the work of recent months and the tremendous progress he and his people had already made as they began their centuries-long project. Dune had once been a botanical testing station, an isolated outpost with a few sample plantings placed centuries ago in the days of imperial expansion. This had been done even before the prescient and geriatric properties of Melange were discovered, back when this world had been a desert hellhole with no discernible use. But the botanical stations had been abandoned. The sparse plantings, as well as animal and insect life forms, were left to fare as best they could in the rough environment. Many species had survived and diversified, demonstrating remarkable durability and adaptability. Mutated sword grasses, cacti, and other arid country vegetation. Kynes had already arranged with smugglers to bring in cargoes of the most promising seeds and embryos. Freeman workers then set about sowing the sands and spreading the precious seeds, each one a vital kernel of life, a grain of Dune's future. From a water merchant, Kynes had learned of the death of Emperor Elrud IX. That had brought back vivid memories of his audience on Kytane, when the ancient ruler had given him his assignment to come here and research the ecology of Arrakis.
The planetologist owed his entire future to that one meeting. He owed Elrood a great debt of gratitude, but he doubted the ancient emperor had even remembered him in the last year or so. Upon hearing the startling news, Kynes had considered trudging back to Arrakeen, booking passage on a highliner, and attending the state funeral, but decided he would have felt entirely out of place. He was a desert dweller now, rugged, hardened, and far from the niceties of imperial politics. Besides, Pardut Kynes had much more important work to complete here. In the deep south, far from Harkonnen watchers, the Freeman had planted adaptive poverty grasses along the downwind sides of chosen dunes, anchoring them across the prevailing westerly winds. Once the slip faces were held stable, the windward faces of the dunes grew higher and higher, trying to overcome the plantings. But the Freemen moved their grasses to keep pace, eventually building gigantic sifts that rose as a sinuous soft barrier for many kilometers, some of them more than 1,500 meters high. As he contemplated, Kynes heard his wife stirring under the shade floater. She talked gently to the child as young Leet sucked her breast through a stillsuit flap. Next, Kynes pondered the second phase of the ecological transformation process, in which he and his team would plant tougher sword grasses, add processed chemical fertilizers, build wind traps and dew precipitators. Later, careful not to pressure the fragile new ecology, they would add deeper plantings, including amaranth, pigweed, scotch broom, and dwarf tamarisk, followed by familiar desert icons such as saguaro and barrel cactus. The timetable scrolled out toward the horizon, decades and centuries hence. In dunes' northern inhabited areas, the Freemen had to content themselves with small plantings and hidden growths. The vast population of Freemen knew the terraforming secret and labored with their collective sweat and life blood, and managed to keep the monumental task and its accompanying dream hidden from prying eyes. Kynes had the patience to see the metamorphosis take place little by little. The Freemen had intense faith in their Umma. Their unquestioning belief in one man's dreams and cooperation with his difficult demands warmed his heart, but Kynes was determined to give them more than just grand lectures and empty promises. The Freemen deserved to see a brilliant glimmer of hope, and he had accomplished just that. Others knew about his place in Plaster Basin, of course, but he wanted to be the first to show it to Freeth and their baby son Leet. "I'm taking you to see something incredible," Kynes said, as his wife dismantled the mini-camp. "I want to show you exactly what Dune can be. Then you'll understand why I work at it so hard."
"I already understand, husband."
Freeth smiled knowingly, then zip-sealed her pack.
"You cannot keep secrets from me."
She looked at him with a strange confidence, and Kynes realized that he did not need to rationalize his dreams to the Freeman. Any Freeman. Surveying the increasing steepness and hazards of the trail, Freeth didn't place the child back on the Kulon, but chose to carry him in her arms instead. Caught up in his thoughts again, Kynes began speaking aloud to Freeth as if she were one of his most dedicated students. "The thing the ecologically illiterate don't realize about an ecosystem is that it's a system." He grabbed onto a rock on the rough mountain wall and hauled himself forward. He didn't look back to observe the Kulon's difficulties in negotiating the tight turn. Its hooves stumbled on loose rock, but it followed. In his mother's arms, the baby Leet whimpered, then silenced himself. Freeth continued to listen to her husband. "A system maintains a certain fluid stability that can be destroyed by a single misstep in only one niche. Everything comes crashing down with the slightest of mistakes. An ecological system flows from point to point. But if something dams that flow, then the order collapses. An untrained person might miss the impending collapse until it is too late. Already the Freeman had introduced insect forms, populations of tunneling creatures to aerate the soil. Kit fox, kangaroo mouse, and larger animals, such as desert hares and sand terrapin, along with their appropriate predators, desert hawk and dwarf owl, scorpions, centipedes, and trapdoor spiders. Even the desert bat and biting wasps. Every small point interconnected on the web of life. He couldn't tell if Freeth understood what he was saying or if she was interested. In her silence, she agreed with him wholeheartedly. Just once, though, he wished his wife would debate with him. But Pardut Kynes was her husband and considered a prophet among the Freemen. Her own ingrained beliefs were too strong for her to question anything he said. Kynes drew a deep breath through his nose filters and continued up the side of the mountain. If they didn't reach the cave opening before afternoon, the sun would pass overhead and bake them. They'd have to find shelter and wouldn't get to Plaster Basin until the following day. Anxious to show them his ecological treasure vault, Kynes picked up the pace. The rocks stood above them and to their right like the knobbed spine of a starving lizard, casting shadows, muffling sounds. The Kulan plodded along, sniffing the ground for something to eat. Freeth, who carried the baby boy without complaint, suddenly froze. Her blue eyes grew wide, flashing from side to side. She cocked her head to listen. Kynes, weary and hot, but with a spring of eager anticipation in his step, went for 5 meters before he noticed that his wife had paused.
"Husband," she said in a quick, harsh whisper.
Freeth looked up into the blue-white sky, as if trying to see through the mountainous barricade. "What?" he asked, blinking. An armored scout thopter thrummed over the ridge and rose high from the other side of the mountain wall. Kynes stared up at it, standing out in the sunlit open path. He noted the sandstorm-scarred Harkonnen markings, the scratched paint of the blue griffin symbol. Freeth clutched the baby close and scrambled for cover.
"Husband, this way!"
She tucked their baby into a sheltered cranny of rock, far too small for either of the adults, then ran back to get Kynes before he'd managed to react.
"Harkonnens! We must hide!"
She grabbed his stillsuit sleeve. The two-man thopter circled around close to the cliffside. Kynes realized they had been seen. He and his family made obvious targets on the exposed ridge. Harkonnen troops often made sport of attacking lone freemen, hunting them down with impunity. Weapons emerged from the snub nose of the craft. The plaza's side window slid open so that one grinning soldier in Harkonnen uniform could extend his lasgun rifle. He had room to swing the stock and take aim. As his wife passed the desert ass, she gave a blood-curdling shriek and slapped the Kulan hard on its hindquarters. The startled animal brayed and bucked before galloping off up the winding path, spraying loose rock with its hooves. Freeth turned the other way and ran downhill, her face hard and intent. Kynes did his best to follow. They stumbled back down the slope, dodging boulders, seeking shadows. Kynes couldn't believe she had left Leet alone, until he realized that his young son was far more protected than either of them was. The baby folded into the shadows, instinctively falling silent and remaining still. He felt clumsy and exposed, but Freeth seemed to know what to do. She had been raised as a freeman, and understood how to melt into the desert. The thopter roared past them and targeted on the panicked Kulan. Freeth must have known the Harkonnens would pick off the animal first. The side gunner leaned out of his open window, his sunburned face smiling. He fired a near-invisible bolt of white-orange fire from the lasgun. which sliced the desert ass into slumping humps of meat, several of which tumbled down the steep cliffside, while the head and forelegs lay steaming on the path. Then Lay's gun explosions began to track down the rock wall, sparking chips of stone that flew off. Barely able to keep their footing, Kynes and Freeth ran pell-mell. She threw him against the wall behind the barest protrusion of lava rock, and the lasergun bolts ricocheted off, missing them by centimeters. Kynes could smell the fresh ozone and stone smoke in the air. The thopter came closer. The side gunner leaned out, aiming his weapon, choosing this kind of sport rather than letting the pilot target them with the heavier weaponry built into the craft itself. At that moment, Kynes's guardian troops opened fire. From hidden battlements in the camouflaged cliff wall near the cave, Freeman gunners shot the armored hull of the thopter. Brilliant lasers dazzled the cockpit viewport. One unseen defender used an old-fashioned artillery launcher, shoulder-mounted, to fire small explosives obtained from smugglers. The artillery shell struck the underbelly of the scout craft, making it lurch and rock in the air. The sudden jolt knocked the precariously balanced side gunner from his seat. He tumbled out of the craft, screaming, and fell through the air to shatter in an explosive spray of red flesh against the rocks far below. His abandoned lasergun rifle clattered after him. Freeth huddled against the cliff wall, holding Kynes close, astonished at the unexpected Freeman defense. He could tell she had expected to fight the attackers single-handedly, but he had other protectors as well. As the Harkonnen thopter reeled in the sky, Freeman defenders opened fire on its vulnerable engine components. The air smelled of fire and burned metal. The pilot desperately attempted to stabilize, while black smoke spewed from exhaust ports and lifeblood lubricant sizzled out of severed transport lines. The craft spun, whined, and lumbered toward the ground. The thopter struck the side of the cliff, split open, and continued to scrape down the rock wall. In vain, the articulated wings kept beating, twitching like involuntary muscles, until the craft smashed into the base of the ridge.
"I know of no Siege up here," Freeth said, breathless and confused. "Who are these people? What tribe claims them?"
"Troops of mine, defending the project." Below, he noticed that the Harkonnen pilot had survived the crash. Part of the canopy popped open, and the wounded man began to crawl out, holding one dangling arm. Within moments, camouflaged Freeman troops boiled out of the rocks and swarmed over the wreckage. The pilot tried to duck back into the dubious safety of his craft, but two Freemen pulled him out. A flash of blue-white Chrisknife, then a splatter of crimson, and the pilot was dead. Watermen, consecrated body handlers, whisked away the corpse to where its water could be recovered. Kynes knew any moisture or fertilizer chemicals derived from this victim would be devoted to the Plaster Basin project, rather than to enriching any particular family unit.
"But what could be so important up here?" Freeth asked. "What is it you are doing, husband?"
He rewarded her with a sparkling smile. "You will see. I wanted you to be our first visitor." Freeth hurried back to retrieve their child from his sheltered hiding place. She picked up the baby, checked him for injuries. Young Leet had not even begun to cry.
"He's a true Freeman," she said proudly,
holding him up for Kynes to see. Below, organized teams began dismantling the ruined thopter, stripping away the metal, the engines, the stash of supplies. Younger Freeman crawled up the dangerous cliff face to retrieve the fallen lasergun rifle. Kynes led his wife past the remains of the butchered Kulon. He gave a sad sigh. "We'll have meat at last. That's a rarity, and I think there's good cause for celebration once we get to the cave." The Freeman worked furiously to scour away all traces of the crash, dragging the heavy components into hidden tunnels, repairing scars in the rock, even combing the sand on the desert floor. Though Kynes had been with these people for some time, their hardened efficiency still astonished him. Striding in the lead now, he led Freeth to the low, shielded opening shortly past noon. The sun burned down, its line of yellow fire sharpening the jagged crest of the mountains. Drifting out of the cave, the smell of cool, rock-moist air was like a refreshing breath. Kynes plucked out his nose plugs and inhaled deeply, gesturing for his wife to do the same, though she seemed reluctant to shuck her desert survival instincts. Then she grinned in amazement as she looked deep into the shadows.
"I smell water, my husband."
He took her arm. "Come with me. This is something I want you to see." As they rounded a sharp corner, whose purpose was to block light and evaporation from the grotto, Kynes gestured magnanimously to indicate the Eden he had made in Plaster Basin. Yellow glow globes hovered at the ceiling. The air was rich with humidity, redolent with the scents of flowers, shrubs, trees. The sweet sound of running water chuckled from narrow, grooved troughs. In a carefully arranged appearance of randomness, flower beds burst with magenta and orange blossoms. Irrigation systems trickled droplets into algae-packed tanks, while fans stirred the air to keep the moisture level constant. The grotto was alive with flittering patches of color, butterflies, moths, and bees, heady with the treasure of pollen and nectar around them. Freeth gasped, and for a moment Kynes saw through the porcelain mask of her face, saw much more than he had ever noticed before. "This is paradise, my love." A hummingbird hovered in front of her with a tiny blur of wings, then darted off again. In their own euphoria, Freeman gardeners moved about, tending the plants. "One day gardens like this will grow all across Dune, out in the open air. This is a showcase with growing crops and plants and open water, fruit trees, decorative flowers, green grasses. We have here a symbol for all Freemen to show them my vision. Seeing this, they'll understand what they can accomplish." Moisture ran down the walls of the cavern, touching parched rock that had known nothing but thirst for uncounted eons.
"Even I did not truly comprehend," Freeth said, "until now."
"Do you see why all this is worth fighting for? And dying for?" Kynes walked around, inhaling the scents of the leaves, sniffing the perfume of the flowers. He found a tree from which dangled orange globes of ripening fruit. He plucked one, large and golden. None of the workers would question his right to the fresh produce. "A portigo," he said, "one of the fruits I was talking about back at Red Wall Siege." He gave it to Freeth as a gift, and she held it reverently in her tanned hands as the greatest treasure she had ever been offered. Kynes waved expansively at the enclosed grotto. "Remember this well, my wife. All the Freemen must see this. Dune, our Dune, can be like this in only a few centuries." Even innocents carry within them their own guilt in their own way. No one makes it through life without paying, in one fashion or another. Lady Helena Atreides, her personal journals. Immediately after hearing the announcement of the first imperial coronation ceremony in almost a century and a half, House Atreides began work on their family preparations. From dawn until the fall of darkness, the servants in Castle Caladan went from wardrobe to storeroom, gathering the clothing, trinkets, and gifts necessary for the formal journey to the imperial court. Meanwhile, Leto wandered through his rooms, trying to refine his plan and decide the best way to obtain a dispensation for Romber and Kylea. "The new Emperor Shaddam must hear my plea." His protocol advisors had bickered for hours over the proper colors of capes, armbands, and mere-silk tunics. Whether the jewelry should be gaudy or understated, expensive imported Ekazi stones, or something simpler. Finally, because of his memorable times with Romber, Leto insisted on wearing a small coral gem suspended in a transparent sphere filled with water. Kylea desperately wanted to go. Visiting the palace on Kaitain, where her mother had once served the emperor, had been a lifelong dream of hers. Leto could see the longing in her green eyes, the hope on her face. But still he had no choice but to forbid it. Romber had to accompany the entourage to make his family's case. But if they failed, the Vernius heir could be executed for having left his sanctuary. Kylea's life would be forfeit as well. If their mission succeeded, though, Leto vowed to take Kylea to the capital world himself, a glamorous vacation that would be all she imagined it to be. Now, in the quiet hour before dawn, he paced back and forth on the wooden floors of his upper room, listening to the old beams creak. It was the comforting sound of home. How many times had other dukes paced the same floor, pondering decisions of state? Duke Paulus had undoubtedly done so time and again, troubled as he was by uprisings of the primitives in the southern continent, or by requests from the emperor to put out brushfire rebellions on outer worlds. In those times, Paulus Atreides had first blooded his sword, and had become a comrade in arms with Dominic Vernius. Throughout his years, the old duke had served with talent and finesse, knowing when to be hard and when to be lenient. He had employed the ingredients of dedication, ethics, and economic stability to create a population devoutly loyal to and proud of House Atreides. How could Leto ever hope to do the same? His voice filled the room. "Father, you left large shoes for me to fill." He drew a deep breath, angrily forcing away his self-pity. He could do no less than his very best, for Caladan and for the memory of the old duke. On calmer dawns, he and Romber might have gone down to the practice courtyard to train with knives and shields, under the watchful eye of Thufir Hawat. Today, though, Leto had hoped to get more rest, a hope that hadn't materialized. He'd slept badly, haunted by the weight of decisions that seemed to make the stones of the tall castle grind together under the burden. Far below, the sea crashed like gnashing teeth, uneasy water that reflected Leto's churning thoughts. Wrapping himself in a robe lined with expensive imported whale fur, he cinched the sash at his waist and padded barefoot down the curving steps toward the main hall. He smelled bitter coffee brewing and the faint hint of melange that would be added to his cup. Leto smiled, knowing the cook would insist on the young duke receiving an extra boost of energy. He could hear noises from the distant kitchen, food prep units being primed, breakfast being prepared, old-fashioned fires being stoked. The old duke had always preferred real crackling fires in some of the rooms, and Leto had continued the tradition. When he passed on bare feet through the Hall of Swords on the way to the banquet hall, he stopped upon encountering an unexpected person. The young stable boy, Duncan Idaho, had removed one of Paulus's tall and ornately carved ceremonial swords from the rack. He held it, pointed downward, resting against the flagstoned floor. Though the long weapon was nearly as tall as the 10-year-old, Duncan gripped its pommel with determination. The inlaid rope pattern on the hilt gave him all the leverage he needed. Duncan spun around, startled at being discovered here. Leto's voice caught in his throat in time to squelch a chiding speech.